thanks for tuning in today. I'm Henrik Kallengren from Sweden. This is Red Ice Radio. I hope you've had a good week and that you're not too discouraged by the decreasing temperatures here in the Northern Hemisphere. If you're new to the program, check out redicecreations.com and redicemembers.com. Bookmark, subscribe to the RSS feeds. Just keep an eye on the websites as we have a lot of interesting material coming through and being archived that we think it's worth knowing more about. Phil Stanford is a true crime writer with a special interest in political corruption. His work has appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, Rolling Stone, and the Columbia Journalism Review. He has worked as a magazine editor and a licensed private investigator. He was a columnist for the Oregonian and the Portland Tribune. As a journalist, Stanford is best known for his continuing work on the 1989 murder cover-up of the Oregon Corrections Director, Michael Franke. His 1994 Oregonian series on the Happy Face killer case resulted in two innocent people being released from prison. Phil is here with us only for an hour today to talk about his latest book, White House Call Girl, the real story behind the infamous 1972 Watergate break-in that led to the downfall of President Richard Trickey-Dickey Nixon. The focus is put on an ex-stripper and call girl madame by the name of Heidi Reichen. Many of the book's important revelations are in fact based on Stanford's recent discovery of Heidi's little black book, showing the full spectrum of connections from the criminal dark underworld all the way up to the sleazy criminal politicians in Washington, D.C. Hi, Phil. Welcome to the program. Hope you're doing well. Thank you very much for coming on with us today.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me.
You bet. Now, great job on the book, first of all. It just lays out all of these connections so well. It's a disgusting story, and I mean, you've done a really good job at getting into it, a story that shows the murky and dirty water of politics. And, of course, this in your book, you're describing a world in the 60s and the 70s, but I would say that there's no difference today. In fact, it might even be worse, and we'll see if we get a chance to talk about that later. But, you know, the majority that we're going to talk about here today has to do with the revisionist version, if you will, of the Watergate scandal. But before we get into the story, your book and everything contained within it, maybe you can just lay the groundwork for us and for the listeners who might not, you know, even remember the Watergate scandal, if we talk about the conventional line first.
Well, it did happen a long time ago. It was, this is the 40th anniversary of the sort of uncovering of the scandal. The Watergate burglary occurred in June of 1972. Five burglars were caught 2:30 in the morning inside the offices of the Democratic National Committee in the Watergate, which is why this is all, whole thing is called the Watergate scandal. And they were quickly traced to the White House, and over the next year or so, Washington was consumed with news of this. It's what brought down, as the information came out, it became clear that not just that they were connected to the White House, but they were involved in lots of other dirty bits of intrigue. And as the news came out, the scandal built, there were hearings, there were prosecutions, and in 74, Richard Nixon, Tricky Dick himself, was forced to resign, the only American president to resign from office.
That's right. That's incredible in itself, all things considering. What was your interest in the scandal, the Watergate scandal, and how long have you been following this, Phil?
Well, I've been interested for some time. At the time it happened, I mean, I don't know how much time to devote to my personal involvement with the story, but I was working for a congressman, a Democratic congressman in Washington. I wasn't particularly knowledgeable about it. I knew what everyone else was reading in the Washington Post. It was an exciting time. I later worked for David Frost as a researcher on his for his programs, and still didn't know much about it. It was only after I came back to Washington in 85 or 86, I realized that there was a book out that actually made some sense. It was Secret Agenda by Jim Hogan. I read it, and I was just floored by how brilliant it was. It's a difficult book. I mean, I had to read it a couple times and have since read it many more times. But mm-hmm. what impressed me so much, this was a different interpretation of Watergate. It's the basis for the so-called revisionist theory, is that it was being completely ignored by the press. Now, how could that be? So I spent some time trying to understand it. I wrote a piece for the Columbia Journalism Review saying, why aren't people following up on this? Why is the press ignoring it? And still nothing happened. So I decided to pursue a couple leads that Jim Hogan had in his book, particularly relating to the Call Girl operation that he had said was the real reason for the break-in. I talked to this young lawyer who'd been involved and who'd been sent to prison over the thing. I got to know Carl Schaffler, the investigating officer, who, as it turns out, was probably tipped off about the Watergate burglary, and because he was waiting right outside when it happened. And I thought that I would be able to pull together a book that would, pay me for my time anyway. But I failed. I spent 6 months, a year on it, tried to raise money for further investigation, but frankly, it didn't work out. So I gave it up. I came out to Oregon, worked for a newspaper as a columnist for some years, and after some years, I left that. I started writing books, true crime books, and after the last book, I said, "What am I going to do next?" I decided to this was a couple years ago to take up the Watergate story again. This was 20 years later.
Wow.
And I started making calls around, and I didn't know what I'd come up with. I obviously had to be able to add something to the story. There had been other books written. I mentioned Jim Hogan's book, Secret Agenda. There was another one called Silent Coup by Len Kolodny and Robert Getlin. And then fairly recently, a book called The Strong Man by James Rosen. Very scholarly book, but there was still, I wanted to find something more. There was hanging over the whole story this woman named Heidi Reichen, who yeah. either was or wasn't the madam who was running the call girl operation that the break-in was about. And she was dead. She died in 1990, but I started calling around in her old neighborhood to see if there was anyone. I didn't know what I was looking for, really. I talked to an old woman who lived in the house next to her mother's house. Her mother had died, too. And the mother said, "Oh, there's a sister. I know her sister's friend. I called the friend. The friend said, yeah, I know how to get in touch with her, but I'm not going to give you her number. I will... give her a call, and if she calls you, then you can talk to her." So I said, "Thank you very much," and nothing happened for a month and a half, 2 months, and I got a call, and it was the husband of the sister, younger sister, and he said, "We've got something here you might be interested in." They had Heidi's little black book and her address book, and so I met with them. I had to fly across the country and made arrangements to get the book and some photographs. And that book is, along with quite a bit of research, new research on the subject, the basis for the book, White House Call Girl.
Indeed. Now, your scoop, I guess, here as well, one of the big ones is that you managed to get in contact with Kathy, Heidi's sister. Is she the only one that has actually spoken to you at this stage?
Was I the only one she had spoken to? Yes, yes. She hadn't. She'd never been interviewed before.
Yeah. Wow, that's amazing.
And there were others. You know, Heidi's ex-husband that she was married to briefly back in 1959 and 60. Heidi's best friend from the time from the early 60s, Josephine Alvarez, a stripper like Heidi,
that's right.
Who was married to the mob boss Joe Nesline. I talked to a lot of these people and reconstructed Heidi's life.
Well, you do it very well, and the book is an excellent read. It really follows kind of the different connections between these people. But, you know, before we get deeper into it, let's just talk a little bit more about Heidi Reichen and who she was and what she was in charge of and how it connects to the Watergate scandal.
Okay, well, Heidi, as I've already indicated, was an ex-stripper she worked for the mob. She started as a nude model while she was still in the army. She was an immigrant. She was born in Germany, in northern Germany. Her father was in the German enlisted man in the German Navy in World War II. They immigrated to the United States in 1951. Father, mother, and Heidi, and lived in Reading, Pennsylvania. Heidi was about 14 when they arrived in the United States. She went to high school, and when she got out, she was about 19. She joined the Army, went to Washington, D.C., was Miss Fort Myer. She was a very pretty girl. And the photographer who took the pictures suggested she might like to do a little bit of nude modeling, so she did, and that put her in contact with these people who eventually turned out to be the top people in the mob. When she got out of the army and was divorced, while she was there, she married a helicopter pilot. They were divorced. She got out of the army. She tried to make a living as a striptease dancer, but she wasn't a very good dancer. So the mob put her to work meeting people, specifically meeting professional football players. To get close to them, find out about injuries, that sort of thing, maybe to compromise them for betting. But that was the big game. Football betting is a multi-million-dollar business, and it pays to have inside information. So that's what Heidi did. And one of the things this little black book shows is all the football players she was acquainted with.
Yeah,
there's a score of them anyway, and the top names in for the Washington team, Green Bay, Dallas Cowboys, the hot teams at the time, and she carried money for the mob. She has, another really impressive, collection of names is mobsters and bookies. She had to carry money back and forth. They have to have what they call the layoff system. They have to cover each other on bets so that no one gets too lopsided on one team. They make their money by taking a tenth of each losing bet. And so if they get too many bets, they don't care who wins. They just want to make sure they don't get caught with a lot of losses. So if they have too many of one kind, they have to sell it to their bets to someone else in another part of the city or another part of the country. And Heidi carried that money. She also carried money to Switzerland. And there are FBI records of her meeting Joe Nesline, the mob boss, and his young wife, Josephine Alvarez, in Geneva, or in Europe, I forget, and going to Geneva. She was a courier for the mob. And it is the contention of this book that in 1972, she was running a sexual blackmail operation for the mob.
Yeah, it's a really incredible story. And if we just back up for a little bit, it's and you go into this in the book, it's very possible that Heidi, when she was younger, that she was sexually abused by her father, which might explain some of some of her behavior, I guess, right?
Yeah, that's really an important part of, obviously, an important thing. A part of her life, she left home at the age of 19 and joined the Army. The younger sister, Kathy, was born that same year, and Kathy herself is you know, reluctantly willing to acknowledge that she's probably not her sister but her daughter, and that she was by their father.
Yeah.
And so that's the sort of person. I mean, it doesn't take much imagination to see how deeply that would affect a young woman like that. In fact, it made her hard. As her good friend Josephine Alvarez said, you know, Heidi really never talked about personal things. They would be together for hours every day, smoking dope or drinking champagne, which is what Heidi did. And Heidi never talked about personal things. She never talked about this daughter, but Kathy. But she never admitted even to Josephine. She did admit it to some family friends. In Florida, she was down there being taken care of by this was some years later in the 70s, and she was visiting in the home of some friends of her sugar daddy at that time, Grady Clark, and the wife of Grady's friend was talking to her in the kitchen, and Heidi told her that, yeah, that was her big secret, that and they pretended that this was her sister, but it was really her daughter.
Wow.
But even Heidi and Kathy never talked about it. But there was, it was more than a sister to sister relationship. Every possible vacation, Heidi would take Kathy with her. They traveled across the country together. They went to she would take her to Las Vegas with her. She would take her to Los Angeles, to Washington, D.C., wherever she happened to be, or traveling around the country, meeting different men. And as Kathy told me, her sister, she calls her sister, was a high-priced prostitute.
Yeah. Well, so that explains, obviously, what kind of person she was, and also one of the reasons why she, obviously, had been very much traumatized. So a lot of this behavior might not... Well, there's a lot of psychological explanation, of course, why this is bound to happen, but that kind of sets the framework a little bit. Because, I mean, really what you explained in the book is that one thing leads to another. You know, with her looks, basically, she managed to mesmerize a lot of men and got involved with some of the most ruthless and, you know, perverse as well, mob people. She went all over the place and was with, you know, tons of different people and worked her way up, if you will, in the political world with the connections still with the mob, correct?
Yes, she did. You know, at first it was, you know, meeting football players, making connections for gamblers, carrying money for them. In 1966, she was in Antigua, in the Caribbean, where the mob was building a new casino, and she met a mob-connected club owner from Dallas, and ran off with him to Dallas for a while. He was connected. I remember Lyndon Johnson was president at that time, and his base of power was Texas, the oil millionaires there. He took her back to Dallas, and she met Clint Murchison Jr., who was from that oil family. He owned the Dallas Cowboys. She met you can see it in her book, her little book, you know, congressman from Texas. She was close to a number of them, and multimillionaires, and so she was making connections to the most powerful people behind the scenes in the LBJ years, and then she moved back to Washington about the time Nixon came to office with her friend, new friend Mo Dean, or it was Mo Biner at that time, Mo Kane. It's hard to know which name she was using. It certainly wasn't Dean because she hadn't Mo hadn't met John Dean yet when she was in Texas. But Heidi and Mo moved back to D.C. and there she started making inroads into the Nixon administration.
And John Dean, as some people might remember them, he's been kind of portrayed as one of the heroes of Watergate. But in your version, the revisionist version, this is obviously a complete opposite. Tell us about John Dean a little bit and his involvement in this.
Oh, okay, well, it's a very important connection, and it's the reason John Dean dislikes this story so much that he always stomps around and threatens when people are about to discuss it. He sent us a five-page letter threatening to sue if we publish the book, and of course we have. John Dean was young then. He was about 30. He had risen using his political connections to a job in the White House. He was the president's lawyer, which was probably not as important as it sounds. He was in charge of making arrangements for the staff. He was he did have a role in paroles and that sort of thing, and commutations, and processing those papers. But he was an ambitious person. He wanted to, he knew that the way to succeed in Washington was to get information on other people. He set about to have his own little intelligence operation, and he succeeded in putting that together. But the whole thing comes together because his girlfriend was Mo Biner, Heidi's good friend.
Yeah.
He had gotten her name through his prep school friend Barry Goldwater Jr., who'd also dated Mo out in California. He was Barry Goldwater Jr., of course, is the son of the late senator. I guess is deceased, and he got an introduction to her when he was out visiting in California. They fell for each other. She moved back to Washington D.C. and although she was kept her clothes at Heidi's place, she says she was staying with John Dean at his place in Alexandria. So he got her a job in the administration as a administrative assistance in one of the drug programs, and so through Mo, Heidi got to know John Dean very well. She's got several of his phone numbers in her little black book, and the mob even used Heidi to lobby John Dean over Jimmy Hoffa's release.
Wow. John Dean is at the time is one who kind of turned, if you will, and started to testify, that kind of was portrayed as being one who helped in the whole process. But you kind of detail this in the book that he switched halfway through when it was realized that they would no longer be able to cover this up.
Well, John Dean is a fascinating character. As I say in the book, a less resourceful, less resilient person might have been defeated by some of his difficulties. The difficulties
right.
He encountered on his rise. His first job out of law school was with a law firm that did communications law, and he was fired for allegedly trying to help a competitor with one of the SEC licenses.
Mm-hmm.
He had married the daughter of a senator while he was in college. No doubt through those connections, he was able to get a job in Washington for a committee having to do with he got a job in the Justice Department eventually, and then got the job in the White House. And he had a job with the Congressional Committee as well. So he's working in the White House, running his own, as a counsel to the president, running his own intelligence operations. And there are those who will tell you that he actually orchestrated the Watergate break-ins, which will shock many people because he's viewed as sort of the hero of Watergate. Anyone
right.
who remembers the Watergate hearings will remember him with his horn-rimmed glasses and conservative suits testifying day after day about the crimes of the Nixon administration. And to anyone who really has studied this, that's incredible because to me and to anyone else who shares this point of view, John Dean is the guy who got away with the Watergate break-in. It's the final proof. I mean, there's a great deal of circumstantial evidence that that's the case. What we know for sure is that once the burglars were arrested, he ran the cover-up. He was dispensing payoff money, trying to get one of the burglars, Howard Hunt, out of the country. And once it became obvious that the cover-up wasn't going to work, he cut a deal with the prosecution and in exchange for a very light sentence, gave up his co-conspirators. He did it to save his neck, not because of any sort of awakening. He was the first guy to get to the prosecutor, and he cut the best deal.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. So, kind of, let's get to the meat of this here, then. Why we saw this, you know, break in at the DNC headquarters there at the Watergate newly built apartment complex and everything else, and we have the connection with, of course, Heidi's organization, if we can call it that, being run out of another apartment complex, the Columbia Plaza.
Yes, about a block and a half, two blocks down Virginia Avenue from the Watergate. There's still a great deal of mystery and about exactly why things happened here. I'm pretty frank about that in the book and try to make a point of it, as a matter of fact, because the people who try to protect the conventional view of it say all the questions have been answered, and it's very clear that the more you look at it, the more questions you have. But basically, the situation is that Heidi was running this sexual blackmail operation in the Columbia Plaza, and the probably under the auspices of the mob, but for an intelligence agency for the CIA. That's a very, unfortunately, a fairly common thing. In the trade, it's called the human compromise operation. That is, you know, the way Washington frequently works. The people get dirt on other people, and they're able to use that as leverage. And the stakes are very high. I mean, the new Roman Empire and billions of dollars are at stake sometimes. So
they want to have people under their control, basically. And to be able to do this, you need to have dirt on them for not going off on their own or actually trying to do something, you know,
exactly.
That it's out of line with the current order. Yeah,
it's an old tradition. I mean, J. Edgar Hoover collected sexual information. The CIA has always done it. Each administration has its own files on the opposition. Lyndon Johnson's right-hand man, Bobby Baker, supplied girls. It goes on and on. And so it's my theory that that's not just mine, obviously, but that's what the break-ins were all about. The conventional view is that the break-ins, the White House burglars broke in to get political information on the Democrats, specifically on Larry O'Brien, who was a political operative, head of the chairman of the Democratic National Committee. Well, in the first place, when the burglars were arrested, they were far away from Larry O'Brien's office. Their photographic equipment was set up on the desk of a woman named Maxie Wells, who, according to our sources, was a contact for Heidi's operation. You know, these visiting politicians would come to town and want some entertainment for the evening, and someone from that phone would call Heidi's operation and shut them up.
So the DNC are the ones who sent their people to this. I mean, again, it doesn't exclude that the GOP did it too, but in this case, it's an interesting reverse here, if you will. And this is what Nixon and some of his people were trying to get to be able to use it against them, correct?
Oh, I don't doubt for a minute that Nixon wouldn't have liked to have the information, but there's no evidence at all that he knew about the break-in. Okay? It appears that John Dean himself saw this as a way to aggrandize himself, to gain power. He had already demonstrated an interest in sexual information, collecting sexual information. He'd sent one of his operatives up to New York to get information on Xavier Hollander, the so-called happy hooker, earlier. So the theory is, anyway, that's why the break-in was ordered, to get information on what to get maybe the Democrats' book on clients who are being sent to Heidi's operation, and maybe other operations as well. I'm getting more information on that now, but that's
right.
The basis for this book. Yeah.
So, Phil, this has nothing to do with the different parties, as some people have tried to argue or pointed out. This is actually about the mob or a greater organization behind it that are trying to get politicians under their control, no matter what party they belong to.
Yeah, and also I've failed to say that Heidi was not just servicing the DNC. I mean, she had
exactly.
clients from the State Department,
yeah.
and her little black book shows that she had contacts within the White House. There are several people in her book, several administration officials, including John Dean, of course, whom I've already mentioned, but also Jeb Magruder, who was the acting chairman of the reelection committee, who gave the marching orders to the burglars. She has his private, his unlisted number and his home address in her book.
Who was the burglars, and how much do you think that they actually really knew about what they were doing?
What's pretty clear is that the head burglar, head of this little burglary team, Gordon Liddy, did not know. He was a dupe. But the rest of the burglary team, and this is where things get really complicated, and when you get to this, people start, you know, who are unfamiliar with how things work at this level of subterranean level of government, to just sort of roll their heads back and say, oh, a conspiracy theory. Well, that's what people do. They conspire.
Yeah, exactly. It's a reality. It's not a fiction, people. So get with it, okay?
Yeah. People, criminals obviously conspire. District attorneys in every county in the United States regularly charge criminals with criminal conspiracy.
Yeah, that's right.
People in intelligence agencies conspire. They better conspire. They're thinking together. That's what it means. Politicians conspire. Let us also assume that people in government conspire too.
Sure.
They work together. They think together. They plot to do things. The question really is whether it's an officially approved conspiracy or not. Conspiracies go on all the time. Anyway, in this case, and this is where it gets really interesting, is that the CIA and the Defense Department at that time were very suspicious of Nixon. Nixon was very suspicious of them, and he had cut them out of a lot of his deliberations. He was conducting talks with secret talks, peace talks with the North Vietnamese. The generals were going crazy. They didn't know what Nixon was doing. He had Kissinger talking with conducting talks with the Chinese to open trade with them. He was trying to establish an entente with the Soviet Union. They considered Nixon a dangerous liberal, which is very hard to understand. Although if you look back, he's probably more liberal in some ways than Obama.
Well, exactly. Yeah.
but to them, he was very dangerous. Angleton, the one of the top spooks of the CIA, is on record saying he considered Kissinger, who was Nixon's national security advisor, to be objectively a KGB agent.
Hmm. Yeah.
So
interesting.
They were spying on him. The military spying operation is pretty well documented. They were stealing documents from Kissinger's briefcase when he traveled to China. They had someone doing that. An enlisted man took the rap for it, but obviously he was working for the admirals. He was probably working with there are those who say he was working for General Haig as well. But the CIA's role has sort of escaped attention here, except in a couple books. The two I've mentioned, Secret Agenda and Silent Coup, and The Strong Man, and now White House Call Girl. I try to synthesize all of them, you know, take the best arguments from them and tell it as a story. The CIA knew that Nixon was setting up his own intelligence team. It was quite a threat to them, and they did what any good bureaucracy would do. They infiltrated it. Gordon Liddy didn't know about it, but Howard Hunt, who he was working for with his partner, was still working for the CIA. He pretended to have retired. It would have been his third faked retirement.
right.
But Howard Hunt was still working for the CIA. He was reporting back to them regularly. James McCord, the wire man, the technical expert, was a high-ranking CIA official, supposedly retired, but he was still reporting to the CIA. And the burglars they recruited from Miami were all ex-CIA cowboys, Bay of Pigs cowboys. Eugenio Martinez, one of them, was still reporting to his case agent. He was still employed by the CIA. So they completely infiltrated the White House intelligence team.
To have control. Let me read something out of your book here. I find it very interesting. The FBI's avid interest, especially under J. Edgar Hoover, in the sexual habits of American politicians is only the best-known example. At the time, the CIA's super-secret Office of Security had its own sex squad, which collected information sometimes from the files of local vice squads and sometimes through their own clandestine operations on the sexual habitats of persons of interest. As would later be revealed, the Office of Security operated several prostitute-run safe houses around the country, fitted with two-way mirrors. Some of the safe houses were used to conduct drug experiments for the CIA's mind control program. More typically, however, they were simply used to entertain foreign and local dignitaries and, of course, to collect evidence on their sexual habits. That's just amazing, you know.
Well, and it was a similar sort of operation that Heidi was running or superintending. I don't know that she was actually running it. She was the front person anyway for the operation in the Columbia Plaza. They had two-way mirrors. They were recording there, that is what. And so somehow the White House, and I'm saying, I'm suggesting John Dean, got wind of that and wanted to get information on the Democrats, of course. And so arranged for the break-in at the Watergate to get the Democrats. There had to be some sort of record there of clients.
What do you think is the real connections between the CIA and the mob then? If we look at someone like Heidi here, for example, who has obvious connections in a way in both worlds, but some of the people seem to be on the higher level very much connected, and they're running back and forth between these different organizations. Who is running what here, Bill?
Well, I mean, that's a really good question, and because it goes to the heart of the problem. The CIA can't accomplish a lot of the things they want to accomplish without dealing with the underworld.
Absolutely right. Yeah.
And for example, the CIA does not go out and put prostitutes on its on the government payroll. They don't collect a regular paycheck, but they get them from the mob. They get them from the underworld. And same thing as anyone who studied the assassination attempts in the 60s will know that the CIA people got in touch with mobsters to try to kill Castro. That's where they get the people to do these things. When they get in the drug business, they are dealing with drug dealers. Of course they are.
Yeah.
You know, by definition.
So it's a very valuable relationship here. They need each other, but still we're back to that point. Do you have any suggestion of actually who is running the show at this stage?
To me, it looks like a CIA operation.
Yeah.
The doorman there, who was the man in charge, who the bouncer was a guy named Lou Russell, a former FBI agent who'd lost his job some years before because he was such a heavy drinker and who sort of bounced around. He was a down-and-out private eye, but he was working for James McCord, the burglar who was still connected for the CIA and had his own private security company that was which he used as a front. So it looked like a CIA blackmail operation being run by one of the mob's girls, Heidi Rankin.
If we look at someone like Nixon again, then, I mean, his mob ties goes back to the 50s. I mean, over in there in L.A., the mobster Mickey Cohen, I think he raised a lot of money for his first Senate race. So if we ask a deeper question here, okay, so is it that the CIA are really concerned with these connections and therefore, you know, ultimately are trying to get someone like Nixon out? I mean, I don't believe so, but is that a valid question, do you think?
Well, I don't think there's any doubt at that time that the CIA wanted to get rid of Nixon. I don't think there's any doubt that the most conservative people in the Pentagon wanted to get rid of Nixon. That's one of the things that's really overlooked here. I mean, obviously the left in the United States detested Nixon. So once the right wing, the far right wing, turned against Nixon too, it was a politically a done deal. They just had to get something on him.
Yeah.
And once the information started coming out, of course, the media was more than happy to go along and present the story that we have now, and to overlook all sorts of anomalies in the story. You know, to overlook John Dean's very shady past and his very suspicious role in the break-in, quite possibly, and certainly in the cover-up. So, and 40 years later, he's been able to pull it off. He's still considered a hero, especially to ideological liberals.
Yeah. So, why is it then that we've only heard the Washington Post version of this so far? I mean, as you say, obviously, there are many books written on this, including yours, who adds a lot to this puzzle now. But why we've only heard the Woodward and Bernstein perspective on this?
Well, I've done a lot of thinking about this too, because it's been so hard to get attention from the mainstream press here in the United States for White House Call Girl, And it's caused me to at least revisit what the thoughts I had when I considered the same problems that Hogan and Chladni and others ran into. It's a very complicated story. Most reporters don't have any idea what the facts are. And so when a major news organization like the Washington Post claims to have the story down, to know everything about it, they are, everyone else is very reluctant to stick their necks out and take a chance of being ridiculed for even expressing doubt about the prevailing myth. I think it's something as simple as that. And there are many people out there who have a great stake in maintaining the myth. Certainly the Washington Post does. They made a reputation there. Bob Woodward. John Dean is another who's fighting desperately to keep people from discussing this possibility that, you can understand, the possibility that he ordered the break-in.
Now, regarding Woodward's alleged source, Deep Throat, you say in the book that there's something very phony about all of this. Why is that?
Well, there's been really doubt about from the beginning among people who know about anything about the subject whether Deep Throat was really a single person or not. Obviously, Woodward had sources. And keep in mind, they did a good job of uncovering the cover-up. The Washington Post, and that's what the movie All the President's Men is about, uncovering the cover-up. They didn't do any reporting to speak of on why the break-in occurred. And they accepted the thesis of the Watergate Committee that it was to get political information from Larry O'Brien, chairman of the Democratic National Committee, and just let it there. It was much simpler to do that. It's much more comfortable to do that. Woodward had good sources, okay, but not necessarily a deep throat. And so many of the stories about how they met and how they put the flower pot out and so forth just don't ring true. There's a recent book by a writer named Himmelman, a biography of Ben Bradley, who was the editor of the Washington Post at the time, in which he quoted Bradley from a taped interview that he found in a box, saying that Bradley himself had doubts about Deep Throat. He thought there was something phony about it. Woodward's and Bernstein's own literary agent for All the President's Men has said that he didn't think there was a Deep Throat. In fact, the first version of All the President's Men didn't have a Deep Throat in it. It was added to juice up the story for Hollywood.
Yeah.
So the question, it's more than just a literary question, really, because if Woodward is lying about this, and I think he is, what is he covering up? And he was getting information from a lot of different sources, and one of his sources, according to CIA memos that we are able to get, because there were a congressman named Netzy was holding hearings back in 1975 and into the possibility of a connection between the CIA and the Watergate scandal. From these memos, we know that the CIA was giving Woodward information. They were bragging about it in the memos to their superiors, saying that Woodward is very grateful for the information, and we feel that this is valuable to us because it's drawing him away from certain things that would be embarrassing to us.
A lot of this is indicative of how businesses run. I think not only in the United States, but actually around the world in the political circles. But people still, they buy it, though. They actually believe what they see on the TV and the polished PR facade of the faces that are out there. But many of these men and women, they're ruthless. They're completely 100% criminal. I think it still goes on till today. And, I mean, what you've uncovered in the book, really shows that. But many are also... There's another layer to this as well, because many are actually They're perverted, in some cases even worse. You know, they like sex, nymphomaniacs, a lot of them, all kinds of bizarre, strange activity. But if we go back to this as a blackmail issue, do you think it is that the politicians that end up in these situations and in some circumstances agree, I guess, you could say, to the behavior that they show? Or is it that they actually are forced into doing this to be able to ascend higher up in the political world? What do you think?
As always, you know, a combination of factors. Your major point is quite correct. The general population doesn't really want to know about this sort of thing. It's very upsetting. As a wise lawyer in Washington once said to me, it upsets their notion of regularity, which they require, and you want to believe that your leaders are telling the truth, that they're honorable, that they're acting in your best interest. You want to believe them,
yeah.
but almost by definition, when people get to that level in politics, especially in a very large country. But not necessarily just in a large country like the United States. They've made so many compromises.
Yeah.
I think Gore Vidal said once a politician gets to the point where he could run for president, he's been compromised 10 times over.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. At least. Yeah. So what happened to Philip Bailey, the lawyer?
He has had a difficult life. You know, he was... As I try to explain in White House Call Girl, he was once it was realized that he might be foolish enough to talk about Heidi and her Call Girl ring. He'd been sort of a hanger on there. He was just taken off the street. He was a practicing lawyer, thrown in the Washington D.C. Mental institution, the ward for the criminally insane. They broke him. They got him to plead guilty to some minor prostitution charges, and he went away to federal prison for 2 years. He of course, lost his license to practice law, and he's had a very difficult life, yes.
Well, there's so many more questions that I have for you, Phil, but we only have about an hour, you know, with you today, but I hope that we can actually continue our conversation here later at a later point and just continue to discuss many more of the connections that you've, you know, made between the people here and the politicians and the mobsters and all of Heidi's connections and everything else. But beyond this, though, before we kind of begin to wrap things up here, is there anything to the discussion we've had today here that you'd like to add to it?
Well, I certainly would like to say that if people want to read about it, they should go to Amazon or wherever they get e-books, because this is White House Call Girl is published initially as an e-book. The paperback won't be out till next March. And get the book. It's an enjoyable read. It's fully documented, but I tried to tell it as a story. And so people who are interested in this sort of thing should actually enjoy reading it. It's White House Call Girl.
Definitely. I mean, we're going to have the links up to this. You have there's a couple of websites we can give out here. That you have simply the WhiteHouseCallGirl.com website, which is directly about the book. More information right there. The publisher, Farrell House, people can also go there and check that out.
Yes.
Is there any other websites you'd like to give out, Phil?
Those are the main ones, I've enjoyed talking with you. It's been a great discussion.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Phil. We're going to round things up here for this time, then we're definitely going to have you back and discuss more about this. But in the meantime, WhiteHouseCallGirl.com, check out Farrell House. We'll have these links up on the website, and do take a look, because it's a very interesting read and a lot of interesting connections to Phil has brought out, so do check it out for more. Thank you, Phil.
You bet. Bye-bye.
Well, there you go, my friends. That's our program for today. Thank you for listening. We'll definitely get Phil back at a later date, so stay tuned for that. There's more to this story. In the meantime, check out the archives. We have just so much good stuff for you guys and gals in there. A year of free programs, and then when you want to have even more, come aboard. Sign up for a Red Ice membership and get full access to everything. Also, at the same time, of course, keep us from commercial interruptions and blinking website banners. Thank you so much for supporting Red Ice and our endeavor. We'll be back in just a few days with more new programs and further investigations into many of the topics that we follow and are interested in. Up next is Kingsley Dennis on the struggle for your mind. Then we have Chaired Unringup, Timothy Good, Russ Baker, Mark Stevens, and later Stephen and Evan Strong. Thank you so much for your support and for listening. I hope you have a great rest of your day or evening, and then we'll speak to you again when we return with more.